Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our November 24th edition of Santa Clarita Valley Aerospace and Defense Forum. I'm Rob Gleason. I'm the chapter chair. Been lucky enough to lead this group since September of 2019 when we started our chapter session. This year has been a little different for us. As many of you know, we've been conducting these chapter sessions via Zoom. This is our sixth edition this year alone, so thanks, Ivan and group. I think we're getting pretty good at Zoom these days, so thanks for everybody joining in. We're located about 30 miles north of Los Angeles. I have a little graphic there. A lot of folks know about Santa Clarita, and we've expanded greatly. And when we meet in person, we usually do it at the College of Canyons there at the University Center, so a beautiful backdrop. I think we have one of the largest conference rooms to connect. I know it seems like it was years ago. Our last session in that building was February, so we're looking forward, hopefully, with better treatments in 2021 to get back to that place. I'd also like to thank the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Council, their effort. Holly Schroeder is the CEO and is on our steering committee. Can't be with us today. But wanted to thank their sponsorship. And what they do is really a private public partnership in bringing business and aligning that with the area of Santa Clarita Valley. So they're housed there at the College of Canyons, and we work very closely with them. So thank you. All right, so let's move on here. A little bit about the forum. 10-year organization. Dr. Ivan Rosenberg is the co-founder and on the call, and we're lucky for him to participate. You know, a 10-year organization in aerospace and defense, and we really try to make it local to our businesses, to our regions. There's been a lot of prevalent topics. We had a panel discussion last chapter locally for Santa Clarita Valley businesses and how we're addressing COVID and protocols. So it's been a really unique opportunity for us to connect. So we have over 2,400 members, have a well-established online presence. This presentation is being recorded, and a lot of previous chapter sessions are available. So we have 8 chapters, and sometimes we do collaborate with our brothers and sisters in these other chapter sessions. And you can see the different regions there represented. And we try to do this monthly. As I said, we've tended in the past to meet in person. We're doing this in Zoom. We'll probably skip a month or two here and there, but there are national chapter sessions as well that we'll go through at the end. Also want a special thanks to the steering committee, those folks there in the blue box. A lot of them are on the call. We couldn't do this without them. It's those folks that are bringing in our valued speakers. In fact, I want a special thanks to Pete in that group for connecting with Major Joseph Deshert, and you know, we're excited to have him be part of this presentation. So want to thank the steering committee. So with that, and I mispronounced his last name, it's Deckert. I want to introduce U.S. Air Force Chief Major Joseph Deckert. He is part of the In-Space Propulsion Branch of the Air Force Research Lab, and there's lots of acronyms, and I know he's going to go through a lot of them, but Joe's going to talk a little bit about really the future of space propulsion. And as many of you know, we have a new arm in our Department of Defense for U.S. Space Force, and it, you know, that's probably going to be the new region and where conflict will be managed. So we're excited about what that means in terms of propulsion. Joe is active duty, been last 10 years in the Air Force. He's been around. It sounds like he's got a suitcase, right, Joe? And you've been in Oklahoma at Tinker Air Force Base and Cape Canaveral, Florida, and Wright-Patterson, which is a great, great Air Force base in Dayton, Ohio, doing, you know, aircraft sustainment, space lifts, mission assurance, development of rotating detonation engines, which probably some fun tests there, right? And is currently serving as chief for the In-Space Propulsion Branch. So, Joe, can you hear me okay?
Yep, I can hear you just fine. Okay.
Well, with that, I want to thank you for being here and thank you for your service. And I'd like to hand it over to you. So with that, before I do, just as a side note, everybody's on mute, but we encourage questions along the way. Joe's going to go through a lot of technical stuff about how propulsion works and where we're going in space, but please enter in your comments. We'll find some sections to address those comments and questions. So with that, Joe, Ollie will stop sharing.
All right.
And
all right, is that coming through okay for everyone?
I think that looks good. So take it away.
All right. So as promised, I'll be going through some of the new or upcoming space propulsion technology for the Space Force. And before I get started here, I just want to say that I have this broken up into kind of two pieces, where the Space Force is generally, going, or kind of what's in the tea leaves, and then a separate part on, the propulsion technology we're working on out of AFRL. But I just want to caveat all that, particularly the direction of the space and Space Force, that, these are my opinions and not anything that the DoD is for sure going to do, or any other government agency. So I always got to throw that caveat out there before we get going. So I'll kick things off with some introductory info. Just want to make sure everyone's on the same page with me. I don't know how much space background everyone has, so go through a couple of introductory items. And then take a look at, where are we at with space today, and what's been the legacy of space over the last, 30, 40 years? What our adversaries are currently doing, what do we need to be worried about as the United States and space going forward, and, really how things are changing, that entire space environment is changing, and new requirements we're going to have to worry about. And then finally, what specifically we're doing at the Rocket Lab to develop propulsion technology to meet those new requirements. And so I've got these two pictures on here of, this World War I biplane, and then this, kind of funny thing here with Star Wars. But, in terms of where we're at with space, I think that we're here in this, we're just kind of learning to fly, trying to figure out space and how it all works in terms of operations. There is a Space Force, and, I think, 20, 30 years or more down the road, it's really going to be an entirely different ecosystem out there. And that's kind of the picture I'll try to paint, at least with this first part of the briefing today. And just some quick definitions of stuff before I get going. I just want to make sure for folks that maybe aren't in the space business, to kind of understand what I'm saying so I don't lose anybody. So just some different orbital regimes. So VLEO, very low Earth orbit. So, maybe 100 miles or less above the Earth's surface. So at this point, you're just barely outside the Earth's atmosphere, maybe even partially in it. Low Earth orbit, maybe 50 to 100 miles or so past that. So this is where the space station typically orbits, and then moving out to medium Earth orbit. So it's typically where our GPS satellites hang out. These are maybe 10,000 or so miles away from Earth. And then moving further out into geosynchronous Earth orbit, this is typically where you've got your satellite TV providers beaming down that great football on Sundays out in geo. And these regimes are what we've historically lived in for the last, 50 years or ever since we started putting satellites into orbit. But what's kind of a new regime is the cislunar space. So cislunar, as far as, what most people consider is, anything beyond this geosynchronous regime here, that space between geosynchronous orbits and the moon. So anywhere from, 20 to 30,000 miles out in space out to the 300,000 miles away that the moon is. And so that's kind of where things seem to be, the next frontier, so to speak. We've obviously had missions out there to the moon, but, no real sustained presence and, in orbital regimes, here in that cislunar space. And then of course, this being a propulsion brief, there's two main types of propulsion. First being chemical propulsion. This is what everyone, the bread and butter of propulsion for space. So this can be anything from the giant, rocket engines that you see on, Falcon Heavy or whatnot. So obviously with this, you have a chemical reaction, expanding gas. You push that high pressure gas out of the back end of the engine and, flinging all that gas out of the back end of the engine is where you get your thrust. On the other hand, electric propulsion, this is relatively new. There's many different types of electric propulsion, but with electric propulsion, you're using ionized gas, and you apply either an electric field or a magnetic field, and you essentially are pushing ions, so, individual atoms of gas, out of the back of the engine at very high speed, but since it's just atoms at a time, force equals mass times acceleration, the mass is very small, so you're getting very little thrust, but it's extremely efficient. So those are the two main types of propulsion, or I guess the only two types of propulsion, but just wanted to make sure folks had a basic understanding of the two as I move forward here. All right, so kind of getting into the meat of my presentation here. So, where is space at currently, particularly in the eyes of the DoD? Many of all the satellites that we've launched over the last 20, 30 years, we launch them, we put them in the orbit that they're supposed to be in, and they essentially just sit there. They try to, maybe do some station keeping, make sure that they're on that nominal orbit, but we're really not doing much maneuvering at all. Additionally, these satellites can range somewhere between $100 million, maybe for a GPS satellite, up to over $1 billion on some of our other satellites, and these things are out there for 10 to 15 plus years. And this service life is typically limited by the amount of propellant on board. As soon as that propellant runs out, the satellite's essentially dead at that point and, can no longer keep it in its optimal orbit. But because these things are so incredibly expensive and we want them to live for so long, we really, as the DoD, have been very, risk adverse. You don't want to put any sort of technology on these things that have any elevated level of risk, because these things that you've spent so much money, you've invested so much time, and you want these things to work flawlessly, for over a decade, who's going to want to add anything that could be slightly risky on that? I don't blame any acquisition program for going after this, but because of this risk adverse posture, we have not really made any big advancements or transitioned any new technology onto spacecraft for really about the last 50 years. We've been using these hydrazine based, thrusters, and, we recently started using more of these electric thrusters on a handful of satellites, but really it's been a stagnation for the last 50 years on these hydrazine-based thrusters. And to kind of hammer this home, if we look at these different types of satellites, so precision navigation timing, missile warning, and communication, you can see our GPS satellites, CSP, SBIRS, all these, if you look at the masses of these satellites, you see that we're, more than doubling, across the board as we move on to these different generations of satellites. You can see that our power requirements are becoming more and more, moving from, 2 kilowatts, or 1 kilowatt, up to, 10 kilowatts. So they're getting more and more, energy, demanding. And then they're also living, the lifespans are getting longer and longer here, maybe from, 5 years up to 15 years. So these things are getting bigger, they need more power, and the mission requirements are becoming longer and longer. And also our launch vehicles, as a result of that, need to be bigger and bigger as well. So we have these Delta IIs, which honestly look like a bottle rocket compared to these, you know, Delta IV heavies or, you know, even Falcon heavy or Vulcan. So, you know, we're becoming more and more stagnant. And I just, you know, wonder as we are trying to stand up this new Space Force and the space environment is changing, becoming more congested and contested. And does this CONOP that we have here, does it play out in the future? And, you know, I personally think that I don't think that's going to work. What's industry doing as a whole? So, you know, where the DoD is getting these big clunky satellites, industry is focusing more on these smaller, satellites that are in the low Earth orbit regime. So, you know, probably these small sats, CubeSats might be, you know, a foot cubed, you know, really, really small. And so examples of this are SpaceX's Starlink. They've already got 800 in orbit and they're looking to go, you know, 12,000, 42,000. So, you know, numerous satellites and they're not the only ones. You got OneWeb, Kuiper, Telesat. They're all going in this direction of these smaller, cheaper satellites that are essentially disposable. And they're launching them instead of going all the way out to the geosynchronous orbit, which is, again, you know, 22,000 miles away, to launching something into maybe a couple hundred miles away in low Earth orbit. So, you know, why is that happening? Well, it's because it's cheaper to do that. You know, obviously, as a commercial entity, industry is worried about the bottom line and, you know, getting away from these big, giant satellites. And, you know, that's where they're going to look for capability. And in terms of propulsion, they are looking for something that's cheaper and can be manufactured faster. They're looking for the Hyundai Sonata propulsion. They don't need the Mercedes-Benz necessarily. So, you know, it's something that we as, you know, DoD and AFRL, pay attention to, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we obviously want to advance propulsion for the DoD, but, you know, if industry starts to pay attention to what we're doing too, and we can inject that to industry and they start manufacturing, you know, our technology, it makes it cheaper, overall for the government to procure. So we obviously pay attention to that. And, you know, I think that the DoD will start looking at, you know, something, you know, potentially like this to drive costs down. And so, you know, our leaders, you know, are calling us to change as well. There's a lot of guidance out there right now. And I've got three kind of heavy hitters here, but I could have put a dozen on here, but I think you'll get the point. This first document, the Science and Technology Strategy, the SMT 2030, is calling on us that, hey, you know, what we have currently, isn't good enough. We need to continue to push new capabilities out to the warfighter. We have to transition technology, and we have to continue to do that at a faster and faster pace. This next one I have here is from the Chief of Space Operations. So General John Raymond is telling us that, hey, program managers, and these acquisitions, organizations, you know, you can't, you know, continue to build these programs based on this zero or very low risk posture. I want you to be able to accept some risk so that we can foster innovation and get the latest and greatest technology out to the warfighter. And then last but not least, the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Brown, which I got a picture of over here on the right, is telling us that, you know, we have to accelerate the rate of technology development. Because if we don't, our adversaries are going to pass us right by. And what we have today is going to fail tomorrow if we don't do anything to change it. And so, you know, we've got a lot of near-peer adversaries out there. Historically, it's always been, you know, you think of Russia. But China, honestly, is probably our biggest threat in terms of the space environment right now. Their presence... and really all domains, you know, near Earth, so the, you know, LEO, GEO type orbits, you know, all the way out to lunar regimes and beyond to Mars. You know, they're expanding their presence. And just in terms of propulsion, they've really been looking into the electric propulsion regime, and it's nothing that's new to China. They've been looking at ion and pulse plasma thrusters since the 60s, and then moving into the 90s, they've added magnetoplasmadynamic thrusters, Hall thrusters, and electrosprays. So they're building their portfolio. And then this year, even looking into a high power, so 50 kilowatts is a lot of power for an electric propulsion device, which, you know, just increases the amount of thrust that you can get out of the electric propulsion. So they're looking at trying to get one of those online this year. And so as mentioned, they're rapidly growing their portfolio. So in addition to Moon and Mars, more telecommunication satellites, looking at space station, and more and more satellite deliveries. However, probably one of the scariest things, I'm not sure if folks on the line have heard about this, but back in 2007, China tested an anti-satellite weapon. So they launched a missile from Earth, so from the ground, and shot down one of their own satellites in low Earth orbit, and created 35,000 pieces of debris that's now flying around in low Earth orbit and will likely stay up there in space for decades and decades. But, you know, the fact that they were able to do that is really scary. But, you know, in addition to that, we've got all the space junk flying around on top of it. And so that was, again, a capability in low Earth orbit, you know, which is, you know, a couple hundred miles maybe above the Earth's surface. But Pentagon report, a recent Pentagon report is saying that, you know, they're developing technology to be able to do that out into geo. So, you know, tens of thousands of miles out into space. So pretty scary stuff and stuff that we really need to be cognizant about. And just, you know, to further prove a point that they're being successful here. So these are not adversarial missions, but just evidence that their technology is getting better. So they were able to land or get an orbiter out to the moon back in 2007 and have continued efforts up until 2014 here, being able to get rovers onto the surface of the moon and have more and more launches planned out through 2027. So, you know, they're having success, and, you know, they're going out to that cislunar regime that I mentioned previously. And so between our leaders telling us to change, China becoming more and more of a threat in space, and then, of course, with the new stand-up of the Space Force, I really think that we're at a significant point for space in general. And, you know, as I took a look back at, you know, the way the Space Force is going, and then, you know, if you go back and look at kind of how the Air Force got its start, I think you can really draw a lot of parallels. And so, you know, what was the Air Force back when it was the Army Air Corps and, you know, just part of the Army? Well, the, you know, Air Corps was really just support for troops on the ground. They had a reconnaissance, you know, taking pictures of the enemy and, you know, some, you know, maybe some air to ground capability where, you know, they had a rifle, you know, pointing out the side of a plane, you know, trying to help protect troops on the ground. So they were merely a support role in the early days of aviation. And so what is space right now? Well, we are a support role, and we're providing that, you know, TNT communications and missile warning to troops, so to speak, on the ground, you know, back at Earth. We are not waging war in space right now. So we're purely a support role in space. Is, you know, space is, you know, currently or was part of the Air Force. But then you have these, you know, kind of great thinkers for air power, like Billy Mitchell or Curtis LeMay, that says, hey, you know, I think that there's probably more to air power than what we're using it for. You know, I think that we can use this as a strategic weapon and, you know, actually wage wars, or there will be war in the air, and we need to be prepared for that. And so, you know, what are we doing now in space? So we've got, you know, leaders like General John Hyten and General John Raymond that, you know, recognize the fact that, you know, future wars will be fought in space, and we need to develop that capability. So much like, you know, 100 years later, where we're using air power as a strategic force in the future, you know, that will be the Space Force. And so, you know,
right now we're focused kind of in support role, orbiting, primarily Earth, but, this regime is going to extend, from Earth all the way out to the moon, here very soon and beyond. And so just as evidence of that, there was a recent memorandum of understanding that was signed between the U.S. Space Force and NASA. And so NASA is saying that, hey, we have an interest of going back to the moon. The U.S. has economic interest, in the moon. And hey, as a defense organization, Space Force, we are asking you to build a defense presence out there and to have a sustained presence in around the moon and cislunar space to defend our interests. So, this has really expanded our area of operation from, again, maybe a 22,000 mile radius away from the Earth all the way out to a 300,000 mile radius out to the moon. So, you think of the volume that would encompass. I mean, it's a huge new thing for us to have to do. And our current propulsion technology, although obviously we can get out to the moon, but to have a sustained presence out to the moon and to be able to go, back and forth, I don't think that we're really there yet. So that's something that we'll really need to focus on developing, to be able to have that range out to the moon. And so, what do we do about all of this, that I presented here? Well, the 2020 Defense Space Strategy says that, hey, we need to build a comprehensive military advantage in space. Well, okay, that's pretty vague and also pretty obvious, but, what maybe are some of those things that we could do? Well, first and foremost, I think maneuverability, again, with all the junk that is flying around in space, and as folks continue to launch more and more satellites into space, collision avoidance is going to be a really big deal. This could be a much more regular occurrence that we'll have to address. And as you have to maneuver, you burn up your propellant, and essentially will shorten the lifetime of your spacecraft. Also, threat evasion. I think threats like the anti-satellite weapons from China is certainly something that needs to be thought about, from the ground, but even maybe from space to space type asset as well. So, building up that propulsion technology to be able to maneuver is critical. And I think that we have to think about the long, not just a new type of thruster, but also being able to essentially maneuver and propel spacecraft without having to worry about burning up all of your fuel. And then also flexibility to adapt to changing missions and also being able to perform a wide range of different missions. So right now, if we want to build a satellite, and this isn't, the worst case scenario, but it could take, over 10 years to, build a new satellite, to get it on the launch manifest, to launch it, to get it in orbit. I mean, that's a huge, super long process to be able to do that. What if we were able to, reposition, maneuver a satellite, reposition it into a new orbit to where it needs to be, and also it was versatile enough, or maybe we could re-equip it on orbit to be able to perform a new mission and totally short-circuit that, needing to launch a new satellite, go from years to, maybe a matter of days or weeks to bring on a new capability. I mean, how amazing would that be? Also, space domain awareness. We're able to track objects in space currently, but there's really not a whole lot of fidelity there. I think enemy satellites, the threat of interference with our own satellites on orbit will become more and more of a real threat. Not only in our current orbital regimes, but also way out to cislunar space. And so we need to build some sort of capability so that we know what's going on around us to make sure that we are not falling victim to threats of enemy spacecraft. And then again, I mentioned the sustained cislunar operation. So being able to have a presence, near the moon for long periods of time. And I think a key piece of that is to be able to have an on-orbit refueling capability. So, as I mentioned, the propellant is essentially typically the limiting factor for satellite lifetimes. But hey, if we could refuel these spacecraft, they could really be up there indefinitely as long as other sensors and things continue to function. And I think industry is starting to recognize the need for this. This company, Orbit Fab, is slated to launch its first tanker here in 2021. So I think that, that's a key, and I think others are starting to realize that that's going to be a need, not only for the DoD, but likely for other providers as well. So that brings me to the end of kind of my first section. So just wanted to paint a picture of where space is going and maybe some areas that the DoD is going to have to worry about in terms of propulsion. With that, I'll pause here for a second if anyone has any questions for me.
Yeah, there was one question that came in, Joe, and it was from Kathleen about how do we defend our satellites? How fast, if one were to be taken down, do we have backup systems? And then she ended it with, are we partnering with any of the G7 countries or any of our allies in this new frontier, I guess?
So as far as partnering, I don't know the answer to that, but right now, as far as any defense capability on orbit, I'm not aware of any, and if there was, it would likely be something that we couldn't talk about in this forum. If there is a threat at this point, really, we rely on the spacecraft operators out in Colorado Springs. If they recognize a threat or collision event, they would just have to reposition the satellite. And that's kind of another issue, is that right now that could take anywhere from hours to days to get all of the approval to do that, because propellant is such a scarce, or maybe not a scarce commodity, but essentially when you make a maneuver, you're shaving life off the satellite. So it's a big deal to have to make a big maneuver like that. So really, right now the only defense that we have is just, moving the satellite's orbit.
Yeah. Okay. And one other question that just came in about, with all of this activity in space, you're talking about space junk and what China's done, is, are there any environmental concerns back to Earth? And is that something that this group would get involved with?
So as far as space junk goes, most of that, it would be small enough to where it would burn up in the atmosphere before it would ever reach Earth. So I don't think that would be a concern. Mm-hmm. I think it's more of a, hey, you blew up this spacecraft, and although that we're aware of 35,000 pieces of junk, there's a lot of other teeny tiny little pieces of junk that are flying around out there, and I think I want to say that we're able to track things down to the size of maybe a softball, and so there's many, many more items likely that are flying around out there that, it doesn't take much, something that's traveling at, tens of thousands of kilometers or tens of thousands of meters a second to damage a, something on orbit. They're not really built with, you can't build a spacecraft that can handle an impact like that. It just would be incredibly heavy. So yeah, it's certainly a big deal.
Okay, great. Well, I think that covers the questions here. Do you want to continue on, and we can wrap up with additional questions if you'd like?
Yeah. All right. So, spoke about what's going on in the greater Space Force and kind of where things are going. But, what are we doing here at the Rocket Lab to address some of that? So maybe a little bit of background for folks who are not familiar with the lab, although – I'm pretty new to the Rocket Lab. I've I got out here in June and have only been out there a handful of times. So some of these pictures, you're seeing as much of the Rocket Lab as I've seen. So We have 450 folks on site, a mix of government, civilians, military, and contractors. So there's maybe 100, 150 government civilians, 50 or so military, and the rest being contractors. The site does cover a pretty large area, 65 square miles. Put that into perspective, it's about the size of Washington, D.C. So obviously when we're testing these potentially dangerous rocket engines, we want to be able to spread out and get away from folks. And so you can see that we've got quite a few facilities, 135 buildings, and numerous liquid rocket engine and solid rocket motor test stands. So a lot of capability that we have out of the rocket lab. All right, and so for my branch, the in-space propulsion branch, we really have a large gamut of different activity that we look at. So all the way from very basic research, so stuff like chemical kinetics, looking at individual molecules, particle physics, at the very basic level, how do we get the most performance out of our engines and our propellants, all the way up until something that is actually going to fly on a spacecraft. So we kind of cover all of our bases. A lot of organizations might hit one or two of these, but we really can see things from cradle to grave, so to speak. And our work that we do, we do have a large amount of stuff that we do in-house. So we have again a combination of our government, civilians, military, and contractors that work full-time on the site that are developing technology on site. But we also contract out external work, and then that's oftentimes collaborated with different organizations. NASA obviously makes sense, and this is all going towards Space Force. We get a lot of interest, obviously, from the Space and Missile System Center, or the SSC now down in Los Angeles, and other government agencies. So we work a lot with different AFRL organizations. There's a spacecraft research lab in New Mexico, DARPA, the National Lab. So we're definitely not stovepiped. We try to collaborate as much as we can to develop the best technology that we possibly can. And what about some of the facilities that we have out of the site? So I'll kind of move around this from in clockwise fashion, starting here at the top left. These first four pictures are different vacuum chambers. So these first four are for our electric propulsion testing. And so obviously with electric propulsion, or really any in-space type propulsion, you want to test it in a space-like environment. And so these vacuum chambers, pull down a vacuum to simulate space. And these vacuum chambers range anywhere from maybe about six to eight feet in diameter all the way to maybe this one here. On the middle right to foot or so in diameter. So just, different sizes for different types of experiments, different thruster classes, et cetera. This picture on the far right is the Space Propellant Environmental Facility. And so this is actually a really cool facility that we have. So it's a 30-foot diameter vacuum chamber. So you can fit, really large hardware, even full-size spacecraft into this facility. But what makes it unique is the fact that it has these cryogenic panels, so liquid nitrogen that flows around the outside of the thruster or spacecraft or whatever you decide to put in there to not only simulate the vacuum of space, but also the thermal effects of space. So a really neat capability that we have at the Rocket Lab. And then last but not least, here on the bottom, this is our E-cell facility. So this is where we test all of our chemical propulsion thrusters. So this was recently converted from a 1960s, 70s era solid rocket motor test stand. We're able to pull a vacuum down on this facility as well so that we can test our chemical thrusters in a space-like environment as well. And so I kind of pointed out some of the differences between chemical and electric propulsion, but again, with chemical propulsion, you're using a chemical reaction to expel mass out of the back end of the engine. higher the pressure, the faster you can fling the mass out of the back, the more thrust that you're going to get. And so this is largely driven by chemical properties of the propellant that you're using, but this can also be limited by the actual materials that you're using. You know, you can only burn things so hot or build up so much pressure before they're destroyed. And, you know, as mentioned, you know, over the last 50 years, we've been using this monomethyl hydrazine and this nitrogen oxide as the byproduct propellant for the last 50 years. So, you know, we're really working to kind of get past those legacy systems and move on to the next best thing. And then, again, with the electric propulsion, you know, you're not using a chemical reaction. You're using an electric or magnetic field to accelerate ions at very high rates of speed. So this could be anywhere, you know, on the order of 10,000 or so meters per second. And so there's, you know, really not so much materials constraint, or you're not relying on a chemical reaction. It's all about how fast you can accelerate those ions. So looking kind of closer at the chemical propulsion work that we've been doing, we've really been focused on developing thrusters based on this ascent propellant here. Like I said, you know, we've really, you know, over the last 50 years have been looking at hydrazine. Hydrazine is extremely toxic. If you breathe it in, you might die. And so handling it is very difficult. You have to wear these, you can see these suits here in the center. They're called skate suits. And so it's just very toxic, nasty stuff that we really want to get away from. You can see a scent here. See the, you know, technician. He's not wearing any, you know, really protective, you know, measures. He's got some gloves on. But if you spill this stuff, you just dilute it with some water and you're good to go. So it's known as a green propellant. And because of its low toxicity. And so we like it because of its low toxicity, but it's also more energy dense than hydrazine as well. So you get about 50% more bang for your buck, so to speak, out of a gram of ascent versus hydrazine. And so we like that as well. The only problem with using this ascent fuel in our chemical thrusters is that it burns really hot. It burns about 600 degrees Celsius hotter than hydrazine. And so we are working to develop materials and also a catalyst bed to be able to handle these higher heats. So that's really been the focus of our work on the chemical propulsion realm with ascent. And so recently with Ascent, we did have a tech transition, which is a big deal for us in AFRL to see something, you know, start in its infancy, you know, build it up to, you know, where folks are actually flying it. So that's a really big deal. And on this transition, it was part of this green propellant infusion mission. It was a big collaboration between our lab, NASA, and Ball Aerospace. We launched this thing way back in June of 2019, and it was part of a 13-month mission. And, you know, on top of many propulsive tests that we did, probably the most significant was this detumble test. So the spacecraft was intentionally put in an unstable orientation, so it was essentially spinning. And the thrusters were able to de-spin the spacecraft and, you know, make it back into a stable position. So a pretty big deal for us again, and this actually just ended a few weeks ago. The spacecraft burned up, I think, somewhere over South America, but learned a lot from it. You know, that data that we get from these on-orbit experiments, we can bring back and better inform the thruster design for future propulsion technology. And so, you know, we have the chemical side of the house, but then we also have the electric propulsion side of the house. And on the electric propulsion side of the house, we've been focusing on what's known as these ionic liquid electrosprays. And so the idea behind these is that you, this ionic liquid, if you apply an electric field to it, it wants to, almost like a magnet, get pulled towards that electric field. And I've got this little diagram here where you apply a voltage to this emitter, and it wants to pull out the ionic liquid. And so I've got a little video here, hopefully kind of explain what is going on with these. So very basic, obviously not a real thruster or anything, but you can see here that this guy is trying to rub this balloon, build up some static electricity on it. And look, you know, water, he's able to pull this liquid over towards the balloon by just with the application of an electric field. And so same idea with these electrosprays. So you have this voltage applied to the propellant, and then you have this extractor grid here. And so the propellant is pulled through this extractor grid, and it forms this cone shape here of the ionic liquid. And as we fling this propellant out of the back end of the engine, that's where we get our thrust. So you can see up here in the top center of an actual electrospray injector, just a single one here. And then you can see in this picture as we move down, we've got dozens of them. And theoretically, we can continue to stack up these injectors, where we get more and more and more, and theoretically can have, scale this up to whatever size that we want and produce theoretically infinite thrust. I don't think that's at all feasible or possible, but theoretically you could. But the stuff that we've been working on is relatively small. You can see one little tile here where we might have 100 or so of these emitters and this little panel here, but it's still pretty small. Pretty neat stuff. We've really pushed on this so hard that I think at this point we're probably leaders, if not in the nation, but in the world of this electrospray technology. And this one starts to get a little bit out of my wheelhouse here, but this is an exciting experiment that we recently conducted or wrapped up. So this E.T. Tempest test was trying to find out, what, if any, effect our test chambers have on our electric propulsion testing. And so, again, we have these chambers that, really try to mimic the environment of space, but at the end of the day, it's an enclosed chamber. And obviously, whenever you're on orbit, you have this infinite volume to where if you're spraying electrons and ions out of the back of an engine, it has forever to travel. Well, when you're inside a test chamber, even at a 30-foot diameter, it's still an enclosed space. And we weren't sure, we thought that there might be some effects, but we're really never sure whether or not that, there was, any effect on our performance measurements inside a test chamber. So this test was an effort to see whether or not there was actually any effects. So we have here in the center picture these different wall segments, and we were able to change the geometry of the test chamber and measure performance as we change the geometry of the test chamber. And lo and behold, the performance did change. And so that's a really big deal for us because we can take those measurements and start to build some correlations on, how these chambers do affect performance so that we can better inform designs. So when things actually do go on orbit, we know exactly how they're going to perform. Right now it's a little bit of a guessing game to know exactly how these electric thrusters are going to perform. So that's recently wrapped that up, and right now, we know now that there is in fact an effect, but still building up, the exact correlations and understanding of what, what actually needs to be accounted for with that. So that was, maybe a little dry for folks not in the propulsion business, but it was a big deal for us. And so, with that, wraps up kind of my overview of the Rocket Lab. So, I would like to get into, maybe some more details of what we're doing and kind of how it applies to the new space mission, but I unfortunately can't delve too deeply into that, at least in this forum, unfortunately. But But, you know, hopefully that gave folks at least a little snapshot of what's going on. So today, you know, kind of spoke about, you know, what space looks like today and where I, you know, I, at least I think things are going and, you know, what, you know, we really need to do to change and, you know, how we're addressing that at the Rocket Lab. So with that, I'll leave it up to any questions that anyone's got out there.
So Joe, a few, thank you. Great overview. A couple of questions. Ivan had one in regards to maturity, and this is a good one because I'm dealing with this every day and doing military work about getting to the right level of technical maturity and what makes sense in terms of risk. If you only get to, let's say, a TRL-6, is that acceptable for a mission commander or a manager to accept that risk? And I guess, how does the Rocket Lab kind of handle that reluctance if, you know, the risk is not willingly accepted? I suppose part of this is just inherent to space, though, right?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, I wish I had, like, a number I could throw out there, but, you know, I think it depends on the program. It's almost kind of like the chicken and the egg in a lot of ways. Like, you know, like, we work with, you know, probably more so with, like AFRL RV, which is the spacecraft research organization in New Mexico. And, you know, I think that they're willing to accept, some level of risk. But I think kind of what they're, at least from their perspective is they want to see that maybe not so much a technical risk, but they're a lot of times more concerned with program risk, you know, whether or not, you know, we're saying that, hey, we're going to get this thruster developed by this milestone, and trying to merge our timelines as far as where we think we're going to be and where they think they're going to be, I think is a lot of times more of a challenge, between organizations more so than anything else. You know, luckily working between AFRL organizations, they, you know, have an understanding of, being a little bit more risk acceptant. But yeah, I think probably one of the bigger challenges is just trying to merge development timelines.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. You don't get the benefit of the established maturity hardware like the Air Force and other areas. You have obviously some pedigree, but there's got to be some accepted risk. There's a question about Letraspray, the technology that you were talking about. Are we the only ones doing that work, or do we have an intel on what others are doing?
So I would say that, I'm not aware of any other DOD organizations that are really working on this. I know that, at least in, like, universities, and we've obviously, partnered with universities to look at this. I think that, you know, maybe in the academic arena, folks have been looking at this. I know that China is interested in this technology as well, I'm not real sure beyond that who else is looking at electrosprays. There's some advantages and disadvantages of it, I don't have a great answer for that.
That's a new area. It's exciting. Question about the location of the headquarters. Is the location for the Space Force going to be in Palmdale? Is that no?
I recently saw an article about that on I think that was Friday. I know that they've really been pushing to put it here. Honestly, you know, as funny as it seems, I can't argue that it would make a lot of sense, but they released, I'll have to Google it, it's online, but I think they recently released a list of top 6 locations for Space Force headquarters, and Palmdale was not on it. I think, of course, like Peterson, Shriver, Kirtland, Cape Canaveral, I think, was maybe one of them. I forget all of them, but Palmdale was not on there.
Not on the list. Well, if you watch the Netflix series on Spaceflix, Netflix on Space Force, they looks like Steve Carell has a nice headquarters somewhere in Colorado. So,
yeah. It would make a lot of sense to put it there, but
Well, great. Let's see. I think maybe one last question. Bryce has a question about between LEO, GEO, and deep space, where would you say AFRL's primary focus is today?
There's obviously, you know, in terms of propulsion, there's going to be needs in LEO to GEO, especially with the, congested space environment. You know, we'll need to recognize the fact that we're going to be maneuvering a lot more in those regimes. But, you know, I think a lot of the focus that we're looking at is being able to get out to cislunar, to lunar regimes, you know, building up that technology to have a presence out there. So kind of both, but I would say that the regime that we're most unfamiliar with and, you know, probably will pay a lot of attention to is cislunar. It is kind of our next horizon, I'd say.
Interesting. Okay. Well, great. Well, great overview. Again, Joe, thank you. Wonderful. I think we're certainly more educated now on some propulsion systems. We've had a few sessions previous to this one about the challenges of getting to Mars and what propulsion needs to look like. So thank you for educating us again. I'm going to just wrap up our chapter session here with an overview of what's coming up. Hopefully everyone can see that okay. So so thanks again, Joe, for the overview, and thanks for your service again. We look forward to maybe some future sessions with you in 2021. So thank you. Coming up, we're not done for the year. I know we all want to put 2020 behind us here, but we have some really good sessions coming up in December. So Orange County has one on the industry outlook and the recovery from COVID coming up on December 3rd, December 10th. Ivan wanted me to note that this is a national one, and one that's a really exciting one. It's some really good breadth and depth on the pandemic and beyond, and what we're going to be looking forward to here. There's lots of good news out there about 737 MAX now being recertified, and hopefully we can start looking at some positive news about what the future looks like. So I encourage you to register for that national event. On December 17th, we're going to have a first-ever networking session. We're limited, obviously, by Zoom. Eventually, someday, we'll be able to shake hands again and see each other in person, and we look forward to that. But really encourage everyone to connect. We're going to do some neat breakout sessions with Zoom and just have some personal discussions about what we've done and what we're thankful for and where we're going forward. That is a free event, so encourage everybody to join in on the 17th of December. And then 2021, I think it's going to happen, right? On January the 13th, we're going to have a national event on A&D companies and what we need to know about the competition in China. So lots of exciting stuff there. So I want to thank everybody. Again, thank our speaker, thank our forum. You can find the information on this slide deck. We'll get this posted probably in the next few days, but the aerospaceanddefenseforum.org. If you're a member, you get information to all of the chapter sessions, and we encourage you to visit. So I want to thank everybody. Have a safe and happy Thanksgiving. It's here. Be wise out there, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Take care.